A couple of major events in our part of the world brought home to many people the apparently tenuous existence of bees in the world. The deaths of thousands of bees from the incorrect use of a pesticide in Oregon a few years back just illuminated a larger problem for bee populations all over the world, and that is that many are struggling. We get a better sense of the present and future by going back in the past a bit. Well, actually a lot. Our next guest went all the way back to the beginning of bees to help us understand why they exist and what they do. Tor Hansen is the author of Buzz, subtitled The Nature and Necessity of Bees. Tor Hansen is a conservation biologist, the winner of a fellowship from the John Simon Guggenheim Memorial Foundation, and the author of a couple of previous books, including The Triumph of Seeds, which brought him to the Exchange in May of 2015, an interview we ran again a few weeks ago. Tor Hansen, welcome back to the Exchange.
Well, thanks for having me back on. It's a pleasure.
So for a conservation biologist, you pretty much had to write about conserving bees at some point, I would think, did you?
They are critical. They are really critical. And I think, like anyone interested in bees, I've been shocked and alarmed by the headlines over the past, well, really 10 or 12 years since colony collapse disorder appeared on the scene and began decimating honeybee colonies across North America and Europe. That incident really spurred people's attention and interest and a big research surge, and people began to realize that it's not just honeybees that are suffering, but a wide, wide array of the world's 20,000 bee species are facing real challenges right now.
And in fact, the second word in the book is honeybees, and a claim that the book is not all about honeybees. So when we talk about honeybees and not honeybees, I mean, honey seems to be the difference, but can you elaborate it from a biologist's perspective?
Of course, yes. So honeybees are the bees that we know best. That is the species that we domesticated, well, really 5,000 years ago at least. And so they've lived very close to us over that period of time. And when we think of bees, we think of the honeybee with their hives of thousands or even tens of thousands of bees all swarming around a single queen, and that is a wonderful lifestyle, and they've been very successful, but it's actually a bit of an oddity in the bee world in that the vast majority of bees are solitary creatures, living alone, making their little nests in the ground or in hollow twigs or in holes in wood or cracks in the pavement, even empty snail shells. The majority of the world's bees are solitary.
Do they not even living in colonies? They're like living in singles?
Yeah, absolutely. So the typical bee lifestyle is really exemplified by one that people are becoming more familiar with, the orchard mason bee or any of the mason bees. And these are the bees that people often are putting up in their fruit orchards right now to assist with pollination. And they nest in holes and blocks of wood. And so you can see these blocks of wood for sale sometimes at garden shows or the hardware store or what have you. And what happens for the annual cycle of that bee is in the springtime, the bees emerge from hibernation in those little nests. They come out, and individual females, after mating with the males immediately after they emerge, the females are then on their own, and they go out into the orchard or wherever the flowers are in their habitat, and they gather pollen and nectar for the babies that they're going to make, for the eggs they're going to lay. And then they find holes, either those same holes or new ones, and they go in and they make a little cell, and they fill it with nectar and pollen and add a single egg. And then they close that cell off, in the mason bee's case, with mud. Other bees, like leafcutters, use bits of plant material. There are various strategies for building these things. And then they make another one. And they do this again and again. They might put six or eight of these little individual cells filling up that little nest hole and then capping it off with mud at the end. And they'll then go and find another one and try and do this as many times as they can over their brief adult life, which might only last, you know, four weeks or 6 weeks. And when that is over, that female then perishes. And it's up to those little eggs that have been laid in those nests to mature, devour that little bee bread that she left for them, that mixture of pollen and nectar, mature, and then overwinter in those holes, come out in the spring, and start it all over again.
So is this a tubular sort of setup? I mean, is there a bee in the back that has to get past the other several sets of bees that are born about the same time?
Oh, Jeffrey, I love your question. Yes, it is a tubular thing for mason bees, and many of the bees that nest in holes or bees that nest down in the ground in tunnels. And there's a real logic to how that mama bee places her babies in that nest, in that the future generation, you know, the work will be done by the female bees, and so they are absolutely critical. The male bees are really only there for mating. They don't gather pollen and nectar to help provision the next generation. So what the mama bee does, and I should preface this by saying that bees have this really remarkable ability to predetermine the sex of their babies, in that they mate once, you know, early in their adult life, and then they store that sperm for the rest of their life. And when they add a sperm and fertilize an egg before laying it, that will turn into a female. But they can also withhold sperm intentionally to produce male eggs. And so what they do then is they put the females deep into that nest hole, which is the safest place. In that if you have a woodpecker attacking or something, it comes to the outside nest cells first. So the females are safe, and then they throw a few males out near the entrance where they're a little bit more expendable.
So mama carries both of the components for fertilized egg, and the males are just there for mating?
They are essentially there for mating purposes. They're just drones.
All right, we'll end this segment there. We'll come back and talk more with Tor Hansen about his book called Buzz, The Nature and Necessity of Bees. We'll return to the conversation on the Jefferson Exchange. You can join us by email at jx@jeffnet.org. Back to the conversation about bees in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest once again is the conservation biologist Tor Hansen, who is also a bit of a conversation biologist to our remarkable good luck. He's also written books, several of them. He joined us a while back to talk about The Triumph of Seeds. Now he's talking about Buzz, The Nature and Necessity of Bees. You can join the conversation on the Exchange, not by phone just yet. We will get there this week, but at the moment we can offer you an email address to join the conversation, jx@jeffnet.org. So you mentioned domesticated bees 5,000 years ago. Who were the people who first figured out that having bees around was a good thing?
Well, good question, and there is there are several ways to answer that, but the first domestic hives probably occurred somewhere around 5,000 years ago, and they were certainly well established by the Middle Kingdom of Egypt, in that there's good historical evidence now for sophisticated beekeeping going on during that period in Egypt, where they were ferrying their hives up and down the Nile in timing with seasonal crops and wildflower blooms. So it's a very ancient habit. You know, we domesticated bees before horses or ducks. We domesticated them before we had crops like, things like coffee and onions and very common things in our diet now. You know, we came to bees much earlier than that, in part because of the sweetness of the honey that they offer, which is just the most concentrated form of energy in nature. And on top of that, the wonderful and versatile wax that they provide, which gave us our finest source of light through candles for years, thousands of years. That was the finest source of light we had after dark, as well as a huge number of uses in medicine, creating writing tablets from wax, in metallurgy, all sorts of really early industrial purposes for that wax as well.
Well, all kinds of things. So let's go all the way back. Chapter 1 deals with wasps, vegetarian wasps. This is where bees began 125 million years ago or so?
That's right. So bees evolved during the mid-Cretaceous period, which, is a period of time famously dominated by the dinosaurs. But next time you see a picture of dinosaurs, you know, try to look past those big lumbering beasts and get a glimpse of the landscape, and you will see a place where the vegetation was still very much dominated by early conifers and cycads and ginkgos and these sorts of things. Ferns were still quite abundant, but there weren't many flowering plants. This was the period of time when flowering plants were just really beginning to spread and diversify. And what happened in the bee world at that time was that bees evolved from wasps. Wasps had been around for millions of years, but wasps were and continue to be predators. They seek out other insects or spiders, or they scavenge bits of flesh. They feed their babies on fleshy protein of one kind or another. And the bees came along, or the wasps, the first bees to come from wasps, made a dietary switch. They took advantage of this growing resource of flowering plants and began to provision themselves and their offspring solely from the products of flowers. And what you saw developing then was a co-evolutionary relationship between bees, those early bees, and the flowering plants, which helped spur great diversity on both sides of the equation.
So it's not quite a chicken and egg story so much as, like, if you have more bees, you have more flowers. If you have more flowers, you have more bees?
Yeah, in a sense, it really is. And this was quite, you know, a mystery for some time. Charles Darwin famously looked at the history of flowering plants, which you can see in the fossil record. There's just nothing, and then all of a sudden, they're everywhere and abundant and diverse. And he called it an abominable mystery. He thought it was a real challenge, honestly, to his perception of evolution as a slow, incremental process. And it wasn't until decades later that people began to realize that it was, in fact, the co-evolution of the flowering plants and insects, flower-visiting insects, particularly bees, that caused that rapid diversification. There was a French naturalist who had this idea and who corresponded with Darwin, but Darwin didn't believe him.
We're talking about bees here with Tor Hansen, the conservation biologist and the author of the book Buzz, The Nature and Necessity of Bees. He's our guest here on the Jefferson Exchange. I want to take a worthy sidetrack here about fossil records themselves, which is well taken in the book. The idea that we have an incomplete record, and why is the distribution so uneven then?
Sure. Well, fossils are really hard things to make if you think about it. You have to have all the right conditions. You have to have whatever it is going to be fossilized has to be quickly covered with some sort of sediment before it can rot or decompose, and then it has to settle out over time in such a way that preserves that fossil in the developing stone. And so that doesn't happen very often. It tends to happen in lake beds or sometimes following volcanic eruptions. Something has to work just right to make a fossil. And there are all sorts of things that are very difficult to fossilize. The easiest, of course, being the hard bits, the bones. That's why these paleontology museums look like big boneyards. Well, bones are hard, and they're more likely to fossilize than the fleshy sorts of tissues that surround them. So you end up with a lot of bones. You end up with plant materials that get washed into lake sediments and that sort of thing. But things like insects, which are small to begin with and which tend to rot quickly in the environment once they perish, are really difficult to fossilize. So you don't have a great number of them out there. We tend to suffer in studies of the ancient past from what they call a preservation bias. We tend to know a lot more about those things in nature which happen to make good fossils. And bees are, overall relatively scarce in the fossil record.
So we have lots of vertebrates and not so much of everything else?
That's true. That's true.
You give us quite a tour of the bee's body tour, and I want to hover on the antenna. What do they do?
Oh, they're absolutely marvelous. If you can imagine having your nose up at the tip of a long stalk that also contained, you know, at least six other sensory organs. You know, it's sensitive to touch. It can pick up differences in air temperature and air pressure. The bee antennae, you know, when we're kids, we always tended to call insect antennae feelers. And then later, you know, you get to biology class and then they teach, well, they're not feelers, they're antennae. But actually, I think feelers is a marvelous name for these things, and that they are inherently sensory organs. And they feel not only the air, they not only have a great sense of touch for picking up differences in texture of flower petals and that sort of thing, but they have an incredible ability to pick up odors and other chemical signals, to the point where just the difference of a few molecules of concentration in the air can be sensed between the two antennae, giving bees a sense of direction for where a scent is coming from, so that bees can follow the scent plume, if you will, drifting downwind from a flower over great distances. There was an experiment done showing that orchid bees, male orchid bees, could follow the scent of the particular flowers that they were after for over half a mile. Scent alone could direct them to these lures from half a mile away.
Does that make their ability to smell things even more profound than that of a dog?
They're incredibly profound. In fact, some of the things that dogs are famous for, for in terms of bomb detection and that sort of thing, are now also being done with captive bees. You can train bees to recognize explosives, and you can train them to recognize even the odor of certain cancers, and then use bees in detecting those things.
Wow, that is impressive. We're talking about bees with Tor Hansen, who's a conservation biologist, author of the book Buzz, The Nature and Necessity of Bees. You can join the conversation here on the Jefferson Exchange by email only at the moment. We're working on our phones. We'll get them functional later this week. But you can join us by email at jx@jeffnet.org. I should point out that the book is illustrated, and the pictures do show some very exotic-looking bees. I mean, what are some of the variations in body parts that they've evolved to help them with their acquisition of food?
Well, when you talk about that coevolution between flowers and the bees, it really affected both sides. You know, on the flower side, many of the colors and the shapes and the smells that we take for granted are there really, you know, entirely at the demand of bees, if you think about it. The flowers develop those things just to lure bees in. And the bees, on the other hand, have developed things that make them good at transporting nectar and pollen. So they have long, incredibly long in some cases, tube-like tongues for extracting nectar from deep flower tubes. And then they have branched hairs, these sort of feathery branched hairs. If you look at the hairs of bees through a microscope, many of them you'll see are distinctively branched, and those branches provide incredible surface area for carrying pollen around. So the diversity then of bees, not only in these body parts, but in the species of bees themselves that have developed, is really quite remarkable. There are an estimated 20,000 species of bees in the world, which is considerably more than all the species of birds and mammals combined.
Wow, that's a lot of bee species, but they tend to be very localized, living in just one part of one state, for example?
Well, there are many that are local and specialized in that sort of thing, but others that have really quite broad ranges that you might find all the way across North America and in certain species. So it really depends, and some bees are specialists on particular flowers, maybe even one species in some cases, whereas others, like bumblebees for the most part, and honeybees and some others, are great generalists and will take pollen and nectar wherever they find it.
So it does not surprise me that any biologist would want to get out in the field and see some bees up close, and you did cover some mileage in compiling stories and information for this book. I mean, how far and wide did you go, and what were some of the situations you found yourself in search of bees?
Well, you know, my interest in bees really developed abroad. It developed down in Central America when I was studying big rainforest trees. And I had genetically fingerprinted a whole bunch of the adults of a particular rainforest tree in this landscape. And through that genetic data, I could see that something was moving pollen among these trees, but not just between neighboring trees. It was moving pollen among trees that were a mile and a half apart. And because that tree was in the pea family with these big purple pea flowers, just like the sweet peas or garden peas you might see in your backyard, I knew that that something had to be bees. And I spent a fruitless couple of weeks trying to trap those bees and learn what they were. Never figured it out. They were out of sight, way up in the rainforest canopy. But that sparked a fascination that just wouldn't rest. And so I've been looking for ways to chase after bees in my work and in my daily life ever since. And so I've seen bees in all sorts of neat places. What is somewhat surprising is that bees are not at their most diverse in tropical forests, where you find the greatest insect diversity in many other groups. But bees really like it hot. They like it hot and they like it dry. So the places with the most bee diversity tend to be near deserts, you know, semi-desert conditions like the American Southwest or portions of the Near East or South Africa, where you have a dry habitat, very hot, and that has a seasonal bloom or a series of seasonal blooms of wildflowers. And you have those wonderful flower resources. You have a habitat with a lot of open ground that's good for nesting. And then because it's so dry, you don't tend to have many of the fungal diseases that tend to affect bees prevent them from maturing properly in those nests. So you have great abundance and great diversity of bees. The state of Arizona, for example, has more than 1,300 species of bee.
And I can just imagine in the springtime when you get some of those great desert blooms in the right sets of conditions, is the place just alive with bees?
Things are buzzing, buzzing indeed. Yes. You know, years ago, I took a wonderful course, bee taxonomy course. It's called the bee course. And when I got the information for it, I couldn't believe it because it was in southern part of Arizona in August. And I thought, my God, who in their right mind goes to the, you know, the hottest desert in North America at the hottest time of the year? But that's a wonderful time for the bees because there's a sort of monsoon that blows through that time of year off of the Gulf, and it drops a bunch of rain, and there's a second bloom. There's a spring bloom, but then there's this second late summer bloom in that desert, and it was remarkable the number of bees that were out taking advantage of that.
You know, the ways in which the bees have evolved to do the pollination, there's an electron microscope picture in the book of a bee with pollen stuck to it. They're really made for this, aren't they? And I guess made for this is really on both ends of that transaction.
Yeah, absolutely. That coevolution is incredibly tight in some cases. I mean, you see, we were talking, referred to a minute ago about what this has done to flowers, but we tend to take it for granted, but the color blue, for example, falls right into the middle of the bee's visible spectrum. And those blue flowers and purple flowers are particularly attractive to bees. So if we didn't have bees in that equation, those flowers would be scarce or those colors would be scarce or non-existent in flowers. And the relationships can be incredibly tight. I'll mention this one genus of orchids called the bee orchids, where, in fact, the shape of the flower itself resembles a bee. And the texture of the flower is fuzzy like a bee. And the flowers produce the pheromones of a bee, but not just any bee. They produce the scent given off by particular female bees. And so their pollination strategy relies on this deception in that male bees of that species believe that they are visiting not a flower, but a female. And the strategy relies on the males being tricked into thinking they are really at a pickup bar. And so that the it's one of the rare times, actually, Jeffrey, where the scientific term requires no further explanation. The term for it is pseudocopulation.
Okay. You're right. Requires no explanation. I'm looking at a picture of the bee orchid right now. It is confusing. I had to look at it a few times to realize that's not a bee hanging off the orchid. It's just the orchid.
It's the orchid itself.
Are there bees that don't have much to do with the flowers, Tor?
Well, there are, in that if you think about the great effort these mama bees put in to gathering their pollen and nectar for their nests and to building the nest themselves, they just work like crazy. You know, it's an exhausting adult life for those female bees. There are as many as a third of bees who figured out that they can skip that step. And they do so by stealing the food from those hardworking mama bees, by laying their eggs like cuckoo birds. These are cuckoo bees. They lay their eggs in the nests of other bees and avoid all that hard work.
Oh, so somebody else does the work and they just go steal it from them.
Exactly.
Wow. Tor Hansen, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Buzz, The Nature and Necessity of Bees, a conversation that you can join by email, jx@jeffnet.org. We'll come back and talk more about bees. We have covered the long past, 125 million years ago, talking about the present at the moment. There's a future to consider as well. We'll get to that when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange with Tor Hansen and you in a minute 15. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are talking about bees with the conservation biologist Tor Hansen, who's been studying them and learning a lot about them from other biologists as well. His book is called Buzz, The Nature and Necessity of Bees. You can join the conversation on the exchange as we talk about bees, past, present, and future. Email only, jx@jeffnet.org. Tor, one of your field trips was to see alkali bees in your home state in Washington. What do the alkali bees do?
The alkali bee, one of my favorites. The alkali bee is not only a wonderful pollinator, which we'll mention in a minute, but it's also a beautiful bee in that the stripes on the abdomen are not made up of hairs, which is common in something like a bumblebee. The stripes are actually built into the exoskeleton, into the cuticle there of the bee itself, in such a way that the material scatters light like the surface of an opal, so that it produces these shimmering rainbows of color that really are phenomenal. So when you see these alkali bees flying around, they look like little flying jewels.
Well, I'm looking at a picture of one. It looks like racing stripes instead of the normal fuzzy bee surface, yeah.
I know. They're absolutely remarkable and lovely. So I'm very fond of that bee to begin with. But I'd only seen one of them in my whole life. I had seen one and captured it on that trip we mentioned earlier down in Arizona, and I was thrilled to have seen even that. So when I heard that there was a valley in Washington where one could stand in the midst of, you know, tens of millions of alkali bees, I knew I had to check it out. And this has to do with the pollination of alfalfa. If you want to grow alfalfa and produce seed for planting alfalfa crops, those flowers need to be pollinated. And they're a peculiar flower in that when a bee enters that flower to gather nectar or pollen, the flower parts, the stamens and whatnot, are so tightly packed in there that when the flower is opened by the entering bee, they whap the bee right on the head. Give it a big bonk, big sock right in the head. And honeybees won't stand for it. They do not want to get bopped on the head. They will go to a different flower rather than get bopped on the head. They don't want to bother with it. So growers knew that they needed either leafcutter bees or some other kind of bee to pollinate their alfalfa. But in this one valley, they noticed a little native bee, the alkali bee, was doing a pretty good job. And so they followed that alkali bee back to its nest, which was along the riverbank in that area, where there was a bit of a salt crust over the soil, and the soil was moist underneath, and the alkali bees were nesting, digging tunnels down into that moist soil. And the farmers thought, well, we can do that. And so this is one of the only places in the world you will find farmers salting their fields. They get out and they create these alkaline nest beds by providing a salt layer over the top and sub-irrigating that so that it's just the right texture and moistness underneath. And they've been doing this now for generations. So they plant the alfalfa and they create new bee beds, and they've been building up this incredible population of native bees that last time anyone bothered to count was estimated at perhaps as many as 25 million female bees, and of course a bunch of males zipping around that landscape as well. So if you drive through the Touche Valley, which is sort of out on the way to Walla Walla in eastern Washington, you stop your car and you can hear the buzz just filling that valley.
Wow.
And the whole community is involved in, you know, protecting these bees now. It's a wonderful example of how we can increase native bees in even a heavily farmed landscape by simply including them in management decisions. Even the highway department has gotten involved, and the speed limit drops from 50 down to 20 alongside the alfalfa fields, and it's my favorite highway sign I've seen anywhere. It says 20 miles per hour and a big, very standard looking sign, alkali bee area.
20, so it's a speed zone for the people going past the bees.
That's it's great. A bee speed zone, exactly.
So that's the success story. I mean, give us a sense of what you have discovered in your travels about how well bees are doing or not. I mean, we haven't talked about colony collapse disorder by that name yet, but it's certainly hovering over the conversation here. The things that have been going on to bees in recent years have not been good.
Of course. Yes, any conversation about bees also has to include, you know, confronting the challenges that they face in the modern era. And this really grabbed headlines in 2006 with the advent of colony collapse disorder, which was a problem where beekeepers suddenly were finding their hives just empty of bees. A hive would just empty out, and there'd be a few sort of disoriented hive bees in there and one untended dying queen, and that would be it. And this was happening for some growers, some beekeepers, I should say, up to 80-90% of their hives lost in that way. If there's a silver lining to that crisis, it is that it spurred this huge surge of research and public attention, so that over the past 10-12 years, we've learned more about bees and bee declines than we ever knew before. And the interesting thing is that colony collapse, those classic empty hive symptoms, have really disappeared almost. They account for only 5% of lost hives now, but beekeepers continue to lose between 30-40% of their hives every year. So we know then that bees are facing multiple challenges. There's not a single smoking gun that is contributing to bee declines. Rather, it is what many experts are now calling multiple stress disorder. And they summarize four of the key ones as the four P's, being parasites, pathogens, these diseases that affect bees, pesticides like the notorious neonicotinoid class of pesticides that are very common and affect bees, and then also what they call poor nutrition, which requires a little explanation. That means simply the lack of flowers in many of our landscapes. As we've become so efficient in our farming practices, we have tended in many areas to eliminate hedgerows and plant fields really efficiently from roadside to roadside, and control even the thistles and other flowering weeds that provide bee nectar, control those with herbicides, so that you get these big monocultures where there might be a flowering period for a few weeks out of the year that provides some resources, but once that's over, they're virtual deserts for bees. And so poor nutrition contributes to their overall challenge in maintaining good health. And all of those P's and the other things like, you know, invasive species and climate change too, they tend to interact. So teasing apart the exact cause of specific bee declines has proven a challenge. But we do now have a better idea overall of the things that are affecting their health.
All right, so they've got to remember the four P's: parasites, pathogens, pesticides, and poor nutrition. And to stay on the poor nutrition part, I mean, it seems like if we've known about the relationship between bees and flowers for this long, that we would have done things to encourage flowers to grow.
Yes. Well, the good news is that we understand better now that, you know, bees need more flowers, more diversity in the landscape. And people are starting to address that by planting native flowers, by planting flowering hedgerows, sort of going back to some older farming techniques of a more diverse landscape. I spent a fascinating day down in the Central Valley of California in the almond groves, where there are these marvelous groves of almonds, again, that flower beautifully for bees for 3 or 4 weeks out of the year. But in those almond groves, over the past several decades, they've developed techniques for harvest that require what they call a clean floor, meaning underneath the trees they keep things very bare because it's an efficient way to harvest. You shake the tree with a harvester, a commercial shaker, shakes the tree, rattles all the nuts down, and then you can come and suck those nuts up with a scooping sort of vacuum device. But if you think about it, then, with a bare ground floor, there's very little for bees outside of those few weeks when the almonds are in bloom. So we have had to rely in that area on bringing in domestic honeybees from around the country. Close to 2 million hives every year are required for those several weeks to pollinate the almonds. And what was remarkable in that landscape was that even though there was so little in terms of bee habitat, that when we visited a farm where the growers had planted some wildflowers to try and increase their bee diversity, those flowers, those hedgerows of flowers, had been almost immediately colonized by native bees that had somehow found them and begun to use them, and within a season tripled the native bee diversity in those locations. So over 10,000 acres now have been planted out with native hedgerows and other native cover crops and things to try to help bring bees back into that landscape. And it's a trend that has, you know, picked up steam really in all sorts of agricultural settings across the country. Long way to go, but now we understand the problem better.
That's an impressive response, as is the growth of pollinator gardens, which are certainly a popular thing in our part of the Rogue Valley. You mention a couple of times in the book that every third bite of food for humans relies upon bees, and then there's an example here. You took apart a Big Mac and took a picture. And what are you showing there, Tor?
Well, you know, I wanted to look for bees in an unexpected place, look for the influence of bees in an unexpected meal, and that's why I chose the Big Mac, because you walk into a farmer's market or a produce aisle, and with all the beautiful fruits and nuts and vegetables there, it's very close to what we expect when we think about pollination. Gosh, if we didn't have these pollinators, we would have far fewer choices in those settings. But what does it mean to lose bees for something unexpected like a Big Mac? Well, you quickly realize that little ad jingle, you know, two all bees, beef patties, special sauce, lettuce, cheese, pickles, onions, and whatnot, it never would have caught on. It never would have caught on in a world without bees, because all you could have said was two all beef patties, bun. And all the rest of it, all those tasty things that make the burger interesting, would have been gone because they rely in some way or another upon bees, whether it is the cucumbers for the pickle that need to be pollinated, or whether it's the special sauce that includes at least 5 different bee-pollinated ingredients, from the vegetable oils that make it creamy to the paprika that gives it a little color, or even the slice of American cheese, believe it or not, that has emulsifiers from soybeans, which can self-pollinate, but where you get 10 to 40% better yields when bees are present. To the annatto, which is a coloring that comes from a bee-pollinated tree, you know, all of those things rely on bees. So you take the bees out of the equation, and your Big Mac would be pretty dull and uninteresting probably not very nutritious.
Wow, that's a lot of stuff that you can trace back to bees in a Big Mac. I wonder if people think about that when they order. We'll go to McDonald's and ask. I was hoping, Tor, that you would get to Franklin's bumblebee, which is native to southern Oregon and apparently hasn't been seen in a dozen years. Anybody have any way of knowing if they are in fact extinct?
Wonderful Franklins. We don't know. It hasn't been seen since, I believe the year was, 2006, the last one seen by a wonderful entomologist named Robin Thorpe, who's in his 80s now, based down at UC Davis, but he still comes up to your neck of the woods every year looking for the Franklin's bumblebee, hoping that it's there in small numbers someplace flying under the radar, but no one has seen one in all that time. And it reveals one of the real risks among those four P's, something that we don't really have real control over. If you think about poor nutrition, well, we have the ability to plant more flowers in the landscape. Or if you think about pesticides, well, we can learn to use fewer or use pesticides that are more bee-friendly. But when a pathogen escapes, there's really no way to control it. Once it gets out into the native bee population, you can't go out and vaccinate them all. And so what is thought to have happened is some kind of pathogen specifically damaging to the Franklin's bumblebee and the closely related western bumblebee, which is not extinct but is vastly reduced in number throughout its range. Those are suspected to have been caused by a pathogen.
A quick final question here, because you can hear the music. Vicky, No Town Given, wants to know about the effects of EMF, Wi-Fi, smartphones, cell towers, whether those are involved with bees at all.
That's a great question, and there has been research on that. You know, when colony collapse first broke out, people were looking at everything from cell towers to sunspots. And there's no consistent evidence to show that, so far at least, that cell towers and things have interfered with bees. There are many stressors, but they've narrowed it down to the four P's and a few other related things.
All right. The book is called Buzz, The Nature and Necessity of Bees by Tor Hansen. Always a pleasure, Tor. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me on. It's been my pleasure, Jeffrey. Take care.
You too.